time with Uncaged.
What's up, everyone? I am Steve Topple, and welcome to a very special edition of Canary Pod Topple Uncaged. Fracking, it's on everyone's lips at the moment. Well, that and Brexit. We've got earthquakes left, right, and centre. We've got the government courting the industry. And in the midst of all this, our campaigners, local residents, and activists. None more so than the fantastic Joe Corre, fashion designer turned campaigner extraordinaire. So I was very, very excited to get the chance to meet and interview him. I went north of the river the other day and we had a chat about fracking, what he's up to because he's taken the government to court, and just why he does what he does on this most dirty of industries. So check this out. Enjoy me and Joe Corre.
Okay.
Right, I'm very pleased to be joined by Joe Corre, founder of Talk Fracking, who has got a lot going on at the minute, and there is a lot going on with fracking. Joe, thank you so much for speaking to me. It's a real honour to sit and chat to you today.
Yeah, it's great. Thanks for having us on.
So we come to this interview in the midst of chaos at Preston New Road, where Quadrilla are currently, they started fracking, then they stopped fracking, then they started fracking, then they stopped fracking because of these earthquakes. And only this week, since they reopened their operations on Tuesday, there's already been 11 earthquakes in 2 days. I mean, what's your take on the situation of Preston New Road?
My feeling for a long time about Quadrilla is that they are the kind of they're the sort of advance guard. They're the fool guy. The kind of company that is being put forward. It's kind of they're trying to prove that this is a viable industry. They're trying to get them first drills in the ground. They're trying to face down the opposition. And there's an enormous pressure on them from the industry to get it right. Because I think as soon as that happens, if they were successful and they didn't cause all these earthquakes and they didn't have all of the opposition against them and they could prove that they could do this thing safely, just like they've said they could for all these years, then that would effectively give the green light to the rest of the industry to get on with it.
Yeah.
And they haven't been able to do anything of the kind. They have been mired with one problem after the next. And it's an indication of what this industry will do if it's allowed to get a foothold. It will cause mayhem. You know, the traffic light system that was put in place on seismicity with a 0.5 magnitude starting the kind of traffic light system was put there for a good reason because, you know, so if you have a sort of threshold of seismicity at 0.5, what that actually means is that you are expecting at least double what the level is set at. So if it's 0.5, that means that the afterquake or the quake that is caused by the initial earthquake afterwards can rise to double what the first one is. So if it's set at 0.5, that means you're expecting earthquakes of 1 and higher. Now the industry would like that threshold raised to a 1.5, and you know, you've seen all the PR spin about watermelons and honeydew melons and that type of thing. Just to put that in some perspective, in the Netherlands, the biggest gas field in Europe, owned by Shell, Royal Dutch Shell, in that part of the world, they have told the population for years that actually you can have an earthquake up to a 4, which it will not cause you any damage. And that's exactly what the industry have been saying over here.
Yeah.
What they've done is they've actually just shut down that biggest gas field Europe because of the seismicity. Over the years, it has caused over £9 billion of damage to people's property. There are just hundreds, if not thousands, of houses that are all shored up now by wooden buttresses. Because all the schools have had to be evacuated, all the buildings are falling down. And it's not just about the property damage. It's about the effect that has on people's state of mind. You know, children waking up scared, having nightmares all night because they think the house is going to fall down. People's state of mental health and anxiety, stress-related conditions. That's all about what's happening above the surface. And in that location, you know, they've been doing what they're calling conventional drilling,
yeah.
right? But what we've seen over the last 5 or 6 years with the fracking industry is just this continually moving goalposts where conventional has now been completely blurred with unconventional. You know, you've got this arbitrary figure of 10,000 cubic metres of fluid issue within the Infrastructure Act, which means that they did this sort of conjuring trick where you've got fracking and non-fracking fracking.
Yeah.
You've got all the sort of skullduggery that's been going on with the written ministerial statements, which we're now, we've got a court case starting in a week's time or so about this with the government. And so, you know, what's conventional, what's unconventional, acidisation, fracking, acid fracks, blah, blah, blah. It's all been kind of mixed up on purpose by the industry, and now it's just a sort of muddle. What I'm saying is gas extraction itself is something that has to end. We now know that from the IPCC reports. They brought forward the date from 2050 to 2030 now. There is no argument anymore for transitioning to a low-carbon economy through using fossil fuels. It's just over. That argument is dead. No scientist worth their salt would support that anymore.
No, absolutely. I think your analysis of Quadrilla is a perfect one, because, I mean, if you sort of go back to 2011, when the whole incident at Priest Hall originally happened with the first ever earthquakes, the very fact they've been allowed to continue just compounds the notion that they are the kind of trial and error poster boy for fracking in the UK, and let's see how Quadrilla got on, and then we'll roll it out. And I mean, the very fact that the government gave the final sign off on them just literally at the same time they passed the national policy planning framework and got bundled that through before they went on the summer recess says a lot. The two things obviously were inherently linked. And
that's,
I mean,
right.
And but for me, because I write about it a lot, it's the arrogance of Quadrilla as well. They're so arrogant and just dogmatic with their approach. Like they're on with the earthquakes that's happened this week. They went on BBC saying, oh, and we've had this exciting discovery at Preston New Road where we're going to get more gas when we think, and it's going to create more jobs for the local economy. Coming out of this rancid kind of awful PR, trying to gloss over the fact that they've just seen all these earthquakes in the space of 2 days.
I mean, that's what's interesting, I think, over the last 5 or 6 years, is that what fracking has actually done is it has turned a lot of middle England into activists, into serious activists. And it has opened people's eyes to the machinations between government and corporate industry, and it has it's opened people's eyes to all of the sort of skullduggery that's gone on with, you know, the sort of PR slogans of energy for energy security, of jobs, of transitions to a low carbon economy, you know, watermelon earthquakes and gold standard regulations. All these buzzwords people have heard, they no longer work anymore. People know that the jobs issue is a dead issue. They've heard it all before in the American fracking industry, all these promises of jobs that never materialise. But quite frankly, it's like, you know, Hitler was giving people jobs, throwing people into gas ovens and whatever. I mean, it's not about creating jobs, it's about creating a sustainable future.
Yes.
And if the argument goes on to jobs, you can create many, 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 many more jobs from creating a sustainable future than you can ever create from fracking.
It's
a non-argument.
It is, and it staggers me that people still lack this shit up when you put it in those terms.
I think one of the things that kind of spells it out most clearly for people is when they look at the fact of who is or who seeks to become the biggest fracker in the UK. It's Ineos. They have more than half of the fracking licences in their pockets, half of the geographical areas designated for fracking where there are potential large deposits of shale gas are owned by Ineos. What do they want to do with it? They want to make more disposable plastic. They want the ethane to turn into ethylene to make polyethylene, the propane to make polypropylene. and they want the methane to run the factory to do it, right? That's nothing to do with energy security. INEOS is based offshore, Isle of Man. Britain's richest man has taken his own residency out of the UK to Monaco recently, just after he got his Knight of the Realm status. I mean, it's got nothing to do with the economy of the UK. This is, you know, the government has given this gas away to private corporations. There is no requirement of any of these fracking companies to use the gas in the UK. There's no requirement for it to be used for energy. They can sell it to whoever they like. And the biggest company by far interested in this industry wants to use it for more disposable plastic. It's the same company that campaigned against the tax on plastic carrier bags, which has seen a sort of more than an 80% drop in plastic carrier bag use. They campaigned and lobbied hard against that. They campaign and lobby hard against any kind of disruption to their plastic supply. And that's what it's about. Is that, you know, forget talking to us about energy security and any other nonsense. The writing's on the wall. It's clear as crystal to anybody.
Yeah, and I mean, INEOS were importing shale from the US to make plastics.
That's right, they still are. It's called the Transatlantic Pipeline. They've built all these ships called Dragon ships that go in continual circular supply across the Atlantic, bringing frack gas from Pennsylvania to turn into disposable plastic. That's exactly what's going on, and they're doing it at Grangemouth and threatening the government that unless the government gives them a nice tax incentive and actually helps pay to invest in this plant in Grangemouth, then they're going to move it to somewhere else in Europe. As soon as we can get rid of people like INEOS and companies like INEOS and Jim Ratcliffe out of the UK economy, the better the UK is going to do, because it will not continue to get raped by these kind of corporate interests.
No, absolutely. And I think what you're currently doing is going to be crucial to that, because you next week have got the start of yours and the Friends of the Earth, they're putting two cases together, the High Court, aren't they? Your judicial review is based around, firstly, a statement by Greg Clark and James Brokenshaw in May, and then the National Policy Planning Framework, which was hurriedly released, funny that, just before summer recess on 24th of July. Which essentially, the wording in that, firstly gave the green light for fracking in this country, but it also, I mean, there was one paragraph which stood out for me, and it was basically that they were literally saying to councils, can you please encourage this? Can you please get people in for exploration? It was a staggering piece of legal documentation.
Yeah.
This is what your judicial review is based around. So the background for that, what's going on? What do you hope to achieve?
Essentially, the Secretary of State has a duty of care when issuing a ministerial statement that is given substantial weight in local planning decisions. The Secretary of State has a duty of care to make sure that they are keeping up to date and keeping an eye on any scientific developments within the issue at hand. And effectively what they did is they renewed a ministerial statement that was made, I think, about 4 years earlier about how fracking is a potential bridging fuel to a low-carbon economy. Didn't look at any evidence, even though we had, as Talk Fracking, had certainly supplied new evidence that showed, far from it being a bridging fuel, it actually exacerbates climate change and is a major contributor to climate change, particularly through the methane issue, which, as you probably know, methane is, at least within the first 20 years of its release into the atmosphere, is up to 100 times worse than CO2 in terms of trapping heat in the atmosphere.
Yeah.
And the first 20 years is clearly the crucial time that we're in now in order to stop a 1.5 degree rise in our temperatures and to try to halt climate collapse. That's now been brought forward for 2030, meaning that there is actually no argument left whatsoever for any kind of fossil fuel bridge to a low carbon economy, we've got to go straight to it and we've got to get on with it very quickly. But the minister simply restated the position without looking at the evidence. Mm. And not only that, they've said that they didn't need to look at the evidence. Well, that's just plainly wrong in law. They have a duty of care to look at it. So that's one of the issues that we're challenging. And we're hoping, you know, to answer your question, we're hoping to achieve a result where the minister is now forced to go back and look at the evidence, and not only look at the evidence, but have a proper public consultation, which is also their duty of care. Mm. Now, they're saying they didn't need to have a consultation and they didn't need to look at the evidence. Well, that's plainly wrong. It's indicative of the types of tactics that this Conservative government has used since day one to try to force through this industry onto a population that doesn't want it. Mm. And they've used fake science, they've used all sorts of dodgy evidence, they've used every kind of tactic that they can, underhand tactic that they can, to try and force this through onto the British public. Mm. Throughout all of this, as I was saying before, you know, what it's done is it's turned Middle England, a lot of people in Middle England, into serious activists.
Yeah.
And what's interesting for me, you know, this, over the 6 years, I have to say, you know, it's opened my mind and my eyes to the machinations that happen behind the scenes in government and with industry as to how all this is allowed to happen versus what they say publicly about it.
Yeah.
And I think it's opened a whole swathe of Middle England's eyes to exactly the same issues. So what's interesting to me, because I believe that now the writing is on the wall and we will win the issue of over fracking, particularly when you put it in the context of the fact that we are now, England is now surrounded by other countries that have either banned it or have moratoriums in place.
Yes.
So that includes Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland, Irish Republic, France, Germany, and the fact that the Conservative Party are now isolated as the only political party that support this industry. Both the Liberal Democrats and the Labour Party have said that they would ban it. With that in the background, I think it's pretty, we're in pretty good shape to say that this industry will never get a strong foothold in this country.
Yeah.
I think what's interesting for me is to see what happens next with all of those people that have had to kind of get off their sofa, get out of their house, go and stand in the road at Preston New Road or any of these other potential fracking sites. I think those people now their minds have been opened, what's going to happen next with them? Because effectively what this industry has done is created a huge amount of activists across Middle England, you know, and I'd like to see what happens with that in the future, really, because it's potentially a whole groundswell of people that could now start to focus on some other issues.
So let's work on the assumption that the judicial review is successful and the government has to backtrack, and of course the government, if they do review it, haven't got a leg to stand on because the evidence firstly is overwhelming. I mean, you just, the situation with earthquakes, for example, I mean, you just have to look at the research from Stanford University, which says that all these smaller earthquakes are indicative of the fact that they will eventually turn into larger ones.
I think, by the way, just to make another point on that, which is a crucial point which we haven't touched on, is the fact that the Boland Shale, which is the largest deposit of shale gas in the UK, sits absolutely underneath where all of the historic coal extraction happened in the UK for the Industrial Revolution. So there, it is riddled with old coal mine workings above all of the shale layer. Yeah. And so those old coal mine workings were mapped very carefully and diligently by the miners for very good reasons to map out the fault lines and the location of the fault lines for safety reasons. Those maps are mostly still on paper and are held in the archive by the Coal and Gas Authority.
Mm.
They show very clearly where fault lines exist that are capable of triggering a greater seismic event than a 0.5 magnitude.
Mm.
And the fracking companies, when applying for planning permission, are obliged to use all available data, right, when they make their submission. None of the fracking companies to date have taken into account any of the existing coal mining data. Instead, what they have relied upon to track to trace the local fault lines and look at the local fault lines where they're looking to frack is either from the geological British Geological Survey, or they've used seismic testing equipment. Now, the seismic testing equipment that they use would need a 5 times greater magnification capability than it actually has to be able to detect the fault lines of which the Bolin Shale over that area is absolutely riddled, right, with fault lines. It would need 5 times greater magnification capabilities to even be able to see them, right? So the seismic testing equipment they're using is not fit for purpose. It doesn't work. The only way they can actually find those fault lines is from the paper maps that need to be redigitized, yeah, to overlay over the existing British Geological Survey data, because those fault lines that we're talking about are capable of triggering a greater than 0.5 magnitude earthquake. And they're over old coal mine workings that sit right beneath heavily densely populated areas, right, in the UK. So what we're saying is, if, you know, to use the honeydew melon analogy, where they're saying on the surface you only feel this kind of... You cannot do that over old coal mine workings where there are fault lines that are great, that can trigger these earthquakes. If you do that, you are courting disaster. Absolutely courting it. You know, we're talking about the possibility of whole roads in towns disappearing down a bloody coal mine. I mean, that's how dangerous this thing can be. And they haven't looked at it at all, and it overlays the entire Bolin Shale,
yes,
which is more than half of the shale gas deposits in the whole country.
It's just absolutely staggering.
It's crazy. It is crazy.
But there's no...
And I sat in the APPG with some people from, like, Third Energy and everything, just kept saying, yeah, but we've had all the best sciences. We've done all the data. We've done all the seismic testing. The lady couldn't get the point that their seismic data was useless.
Yeah.
Pointless, useless, didn't map anything.
Mm.
And finally, the penny dropped, you know, after Peter Stiles, the sort of foremost authority on historic mine workings and seismicity in this country, kept telling her, your data is useless.
Yeah.
It doesn't provide any insight whatsoever. And the fact that one of the proposed INEOS wells in Marsh Lane is less than 10 metres away from a fault line.
It's unbelievable. I mean, I try not to be shocked anymore by these people, but it is just still staggering. And, of course, Peter Stiles, if you don't know, is a professor of geophysics who used to advise the government. He used to be a government advisor.
He's a pro-fracker, by the way. And he's told them, you cannot frack the Bolin Shale.
Yeah.
Not from where you're suggesting you're going to frack it from. I mean, you know, that he's told him you can't do it, and he doesn't want to be the one to come afterwards and say, I told you so, after there's some major incident.
No.
You know.
And this is exactly, I mean, this is part of what you talk about when you talk about sort of the environmental assessment within your judicial review.
This is what we're talking about, the gold standard of regulations in this country, where they don't actually look at any of the available evidence.
Yeah.
And they don't look at the science, and they don't listen to the scientists. And in the case of Brockham, where they're doing acidisation, there's no regulation at all.
What is this? Because I hadn't heard of this. What's going on?
So the situation down in Brockham, in the Weald, is that Angus Energy have a license for conventional drilling, right? And it's an old license, and the under the new fracking guidelines, they haven't been given a new licence, and they haven't been, if you like, their status hasn't been changed to unconventional drilling. So under the old licensing regulations, they are allowed to carry on without any oversight whatsoever. So there's no baseline monitoring of any water. There's no monitoring of any chemicals or acids or anything that they're putting down in the ground. There was no monitoring or requirement for monitoring or any regulation with regard to reinjection until extremely recently, when they had to give them a new license and say, well, now you have to tell us when you're reinjecting before you just carry on with it. But they've been carrying on for the last couple of years and no one knows what they've been doing. There is zero regulation. Mm. That's the standard of gold standard regulations in this country. Zero.
Yeah. No.
Brockham is a perfect example of where that's happening.
Because the Weald Basin, correct me if I'm wrong, that was the one where I think it was the guy from Angus Energy said, oh yes, there's going to be 100 million barrels a day coming out of this. I think he flogged off a load of shares he announced this, and then he went about 6 months later, we got that wrong. Yeah, there isn't going to be 100 million barrels. Right. It's going to be about 0.5 or whatever it was. What's going on in the Weald is extremely dodgy
Gatwick,
as well.
Gusher and all
So this is what your judicial review is looking to sort of take head on, as it were. I mean, as we've discussed,
we're just trying to really hold ministers and government to account and to hold them to exercising the duty of care that they're required to do.
Yeah.
And that's what we're trying to do. They've just tried to pull the wool over everyone's eyes and push these things through and sweep things under the carpet and push them through without people being able to do anything about it.
Yeah.
And we're not going to stand for it. And so, you know, unfortunately, we have to, you know, spend time, resources, and court time and resources trying to bring these people to account.
The most telling aspect of all this is the Department for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy, their own quarterly survey on energy in the UK, which they do, and they specifically ask about shale gas. Public opposition to shale gas has gone up by, I think it was something like 18% since they started this survey in December 2013. It's now sat at 31% the public oppose fracking. Yeah. The amount that support fracking has gone down by 12% since December 2013 is now stood at 15%, and people still don't know. And the majority of people who oppose fracking, according to this survey, are people who consider themselves very well informed on fracking. So it's like, the more people find out about fracking, the more they don't like it. And yet, again, the government commissions these surveys, and if they don't like the results, they just ignore them blatantly, because there's no public support for this.
And they decided, I think, on the future surveys, not to have any questions about fracking.
It's been
because they don't want the answer.
It's just, my mind is blown. But they do this all the time. I mean, just on a side note, they did the same thing with poverty targets. And poverty was rising, child poverty specifically. Right. They didn't like that. So they just changed the measurement of poverty to make it all look better again.
Yeah,
and you used to repeatedly see this kind of madness from government. I'm interested because previously, obviously, you were most well known as a fashion designer, entrepreneur. Fracking. Why have you become so impassioned about that?
I was invited to Reclaim the Power camp down in Balkan about 6 years ago, who were protesting against a proposed fracking site down there. And at that time, I wasn't really sure what it was. I hadn't really heard much about fracking, didn't really know what it was. And I started to look into it, and I was just really shocked to think that this was an industry that actually, at the time, David Cameron and his kind of Bullingdon Boy Club were supporting to the hilt. And when I started to see the kind of PR soundbitey statements that were coming out of their mouths, like, you know, uses as much water as an average golf course, energy security, blah blah blah, all the nonsense that they were repeating from what had happened in the US, because we were suddenly sort of in touch with and starting to look at what was going on in the US, and they were using exactly the same tactics, and people from the US fracking industry and companies like Halliburton were having private meetings with Cameron and his team, and I was just shocked, and I thought something has to be done. And I committed at that stage to seeing this thing through, and 6 years later I'm still here, and I'm sort of looking forward to winning, because I want my life back in some ways, but I suppose in others, it's never going to come back as it was, because I'm sort of I'm kind of used to fighting now, and so, you know, once we win this one on fracking, I mean, then I'll sort of be able to concentrate my efforts more heavily in other areas. So,
yeah.
I don't know. I'm a committed activist these days.
It's a bugger, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I don't know. Yeah, yes and no. I mean, I think in some ways, what will happen when we win, and this is banned for good from this country, I think it will give us the confidence to say, well, we can win in other things.
Yeah.
And it will give us the experience to know how to do it and what to expect from the other side. Because what's also obvious to me is, despite this industry, this fracking industry, having all these huge resources and all the legal support they want and everything else, they're actually really pretty stupid people, and they make stupid mistakes all the time and open themselves up for their own goals all the time. And if you understand how they work, they're not frightening at all. They're just stupid, and you actually kind of think, you know, you can run rings around them. They you know.
Yeah.
And on the sort of, you know, even if over those 6 years combined, including all the legal cases we've fought, all the campaigning we've done, all the touring and talks and everything that I've done over the last 6 years, maybe it might add up to, I don't know, £300,000 or £400,000 worth of money that we've had from various sources to kind of fight this fight. If we're able to kind of say, well, actually, we were able to beat this industry on, let's even call it £1 million, was nothing like that kind of figure, but even if it was, that's a drop in the ocean compared to what these people have had to invest, and it will make them sick to the stomach, and I'll be gloating over that.
I think the point you made earlier was also very interesting about what will happen to the campaigners next, because I've seen it, as you have, with campaigns, especially at Preston New Road. I mean, as you say, they're sort of middle Englanders who've come out of nowhere and suddenly become activists, sort of the likes of Tina Rothery and the Nanas from Lancashire, the perfect example of that. And I don't think this anger, because ultimately, while it's anger at fracking, I think there's something more deep-seated, especially in across the world as a whole, going on at the minute. You see it with the Yellow Jackets movement in France, and you see it with the Extinction Rebellion movement over here. There's an increasing frustration among the public about the system, as it were, and how it's screwing people over, and there's been sort of a dawning, an awakening almost, if you like, recently, about how the system doesn't work for people anymore, regardless of what political party is in as well, I think. And I think it'd be interesting to see, as you say, what the fracking campaigners, when you stop this, not if, because I think we are at a tipping point with it. I think you will banish it from this country. It's going to happen. What these campaigners will do.
I agree, because what's actually happened is you've got people who've never been on a protest in their life, probably never spoken to their MP before in their life, never signed a petition before in their life, certainly never gone on the front line and stood outside a protest camp and spoken to people who look a bit kind of, you know, protesty or whatever before in their life.
Yeah.
And those people have now come together in a sort of community of sorts, from people who would never really ordinarily have anything to do with each other.
Yeah.
Now come together and sharing information, sharing their concerns, sharing, you know, become, you know, shared in all that camaraderie, and I think in the end have built a movement that's going to not only defeat the government and the industry, but it's going to be left as one where people can feel proud for what they've achieved and will be encouraged that they can do more. And so I think what's interesting is to see how that movement is harnessed, if you like, to sort of fight for what, you know, for the kind of legacy that we want to leave our children, and for, you know, trying to leave the world in a much better place than when they found it, and start to stick up for some of the things that, quite frankly, for far too long we've left up to politicians with vested interests to kind of make laws and policies that are not in the interests of not only the people in this country, but for the wider world as a whole.
And I think that note on campaigners is a fitting way to end this, Joe, because, I mean, what's, for me, over the past sort of 5 years I've been involved, my main takeaway when I look back sort of on my deathbed about my life, one of them is fracking campaigners, because, I mean, it's just been absolutely fantastic, especially up in Lancashire, watching just how the movement has evolved, and they always inspire me, and they're a wonderful group of people. Absolutely amazing.
Yeah. So. No, very inspiring, absolutely.
Joe, it has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking to me. It's very, very exciting, I have
to say. You're welcome. It's been great.
Thank you very much. Cheers.
Thank you.
And that's it, me and Joe Corey done. I would, of course, like to thank my very special guest, Joe. It was fantastic. Thank you so much for speaking to me. You can follow him on Twitter. It's at RealJoeCorey. Also, of course, get involved with Talk Fracking. You can follow them on Twitter. It's at Talk Fracking, or go to www.talkfracking.org. Thank you also to Richard Hillgrove at 6 Hillgrove Public Relations for setting all that up. Fantastic job, Richard. Thank you. And as always, thanks to Canary for letting me be uncaged on this very special edition. I'm now off to prepare for Sunday show. Good grief, yes, it's that time of the week already. So until then, look after yourselves.
Uncaged.